God's incredible book would be the topic that we're going on with here today. Didn't get to this one, did we? Here we go. God's incredible book. I could be tempted, you see, because I am weak and easily distracted to continue on Dan's soapbox for a while, because that's fun to talk about that, you see. But I'll not do that. I'll go on and talk about the theme that I have been sharing with you over the past several days. And that theme is the Bible, God's incredible book. We've looked at some things already. We've talked a little bit, and I really want to emphasize a little bit. There's all kinds of things we could talk about in these areas, and I have just picked on some odds and ends to share with you. But we have talked about the archaeology in the Bible, how archaeology illuminates the text, and how archaeology affirms the text. And I will just mention that I did put a bibliography on the table up here. I didn't make just lots of copies, but there are 20-some copies if anyone wants a bibliography of some of the reference materials that I have used in putting these lessons together. You're welcome to take a copy of that. And if we run out, then I'll have to make some more. But I suspect that a lot of you aren't really that worried about getting the resources, so there's probably enough. We also are going to talk today about eyewitness accounts, and we'll be looking at the scriptures a little bit more than we have on previous days. And then we will talk just a little bit about other written support, and time permitting, we're going to go on and introduce a new topic area before the day is over. But I want to think first with you this afternoon about eyewitness testimony. The New Testament is presented to us as consisting largely of eyewitness testimony. Now that's true of significant portions of the Old Testament as well. But for the most part, the New Testament is presented to us as being eyewitness testimony. Things written down by people who participated in the events or saw the events that transpired or had close connection with the events that transpired. Paul presents himself as an eyewitness in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And we could start at verse 1, but for the sake of brevity, I'm going to pick it up at verse 6. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 6 through 8, Paul says, after that, he appeared. Now, those of you who know the passage, who is the he that Paul is talking about? Jesus Christ. And after what he appeared? After his death, burial, and resurrection. Okay, there were several resurrection appearances that Paul made reference to. After that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. When Paul says that, what's the point of him saying that he has appeared to these brethren, most of whom are still alive? What's he seem to be suggesting there? You can talk to these folks if you want to. There's lots of people that you can talk to. Paul is writing this in the 50s. He's writing this 20-some years after the events have taken place, and he says a lot of people that saw this are still alive, and he invites you to check it out. Well, he's not inviting me to check it out because those folks aren't there now, but it's significant and it's important that he did invite people to check it out. There's really no doubt of Paul having written this. There's no serious doubt at all of Paul having written 1 Corinthians and of it being written in the mid-first century, and of there being living people that Paul could be referring to as someone that you could go and talk to about the events that are described, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. Then he, Jesus, appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, he appeared to me also as to one abnormally born. Does anyone know what happened to James on account of his relationship with Jesus Christ? He was executed, okay? It wasn't actually beheading, that was a different James. This is James, the brother of Jesus, that Paul's referring to. And we have a non-biblical resource in Josephus that tells us about James being put to death in the city of Jerusalem because of the heated activity and the turmoil that was taking place there in the 60s. I'm not going to dwell too much on what Josephus has to say about things like that, but at the time Paul was writing, he says James is an eyewitness. And I want us to have in mind from the very outset that these eyewitnesses were very strongly committed to what they said they had seen. They were very strongly convinced of the truth of what they claimed, and that certainly includes Paul as well. So Jesus appeared to James and to all the apostles, and last of all, he appeared to me also as to one abnormally born. I want to ask you, what kind of a witness was Paul? And the easy answer is an eyewitness, but that's not what I'm looking for. What kind of a witness would you say Paul was? What do you know about Paul, the man? Was he a credible witness? Was he a reasonable witness? Was he someone that you would pay attention to? I'm hearing yes, he is. What do we know about him? He was educated. How educated was he? Okay. He was well trained in a classical type of education for his day. The city that he grew up in, Tarsus, was a center of learning. Paul had a background in the Greek classics. He quotes them in several of his speeches and his writings, makes reference to Greek classics. So he had a reasonably good Greek education. He could stand with the philosophers and talk with them in a reasonable way. What about his Jewish education? He was educated at the feet of Gamaliel, he says, in Acts chapter 22, when he is offering his defense to a mob of Jews there in the area of the temple grounds. Now, who was Gamaliel? Never mind, okay. Who was Gamaliel? What do we know about Gamaliel? We know he was a reasonable guy because of his attitude that's displayed in the book of Acts, but he was not just a rabbi, but a rabban. He was a high, exalted rabbi. He was a tremendously respected teacher among the Jews. He is known to us in other sources, Jewish sources, besides the New Testament. And when Paul says that he's trained at the feet of Gamaliel, he is making a high claim. This is name-dropping of a high order, and something that certainly could have been checked and verified whether that was true or not, whether he had indeed studied under Gamaliel. But this would be like a science student saying, I studied under Einstein, or someone of that kind of a caliber. Or a psychology student saying, I studied under Freud, which wouldn't lend itself to my admiration, but would be a claim to really strong connections in terms of the education that was involved there. So Paul was a man of good educational caliber, good educational background. We also know a number of other things about him that lend themselves to us thinking that he was a reliable witness, not least of which is that we have a certainty that he did not start out as a friendly witness. He started out as a hostile witness. He did not want to believe this. He did not want to be convinced that this was true. And when we get a little further down the line, we'll see that the accounts that we have, not only Paul's own statements about himself, but the statements of others about him, are also certainly trustworthy accounts. Paul comes across to us as a credible eyewitness because, number one, he was no idiot. He was a man who knew what he was about. He was a man who was respected by his peers, respected among the educated people of his time, and he was a man who was dragged, you might say, kicking and screaming into the position that he found himself in. And ultimately, he was a man who gave his life for his convictions. He believed it so strongly, and this is beyond doubt, that he submitted himself to death rather than renounce his conviction that Jesus Christ is the resurrected Son of God. So his eyewitness testimony is, I believe, very powerful in terms of his descriptions of what Jesus had done and what we can put our confidence in. We come to Peter. In 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 16, Peter says, we did not follow cleverly invented stories when we told you about the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. Now, what about Peter? Peter claims to be an eyewitness. The gospel accounts put him on the scene. Is Peter a credible eyewitness? What sort of a man was he? He was willing to die for Christ. He was a fisherman.
He made a big mistake.
Couldn't hear that?
He corrected his big mistake.
He corrected his big mistake. Yes, he did. Corrected several not so big, too. All right? When we think of Peter as a fisherman, sometimes what comes through to us is the analysis of the folks who were in the Sanhedrin, who, looking at Peter and John, had a very low regard for them. And what did they say about Peter and John? These are ordinary men, and a little worse than that, wasn't it? Ignorant men. And unfortunately, I think that perception carries over sometimes into the church, and the credibility of these men is undermined somewhat. That's not a statement by any friendly witness, anyone who knew Peter and John and Andrew and James and the others who were associated with Jesus. This is a consensus of religious elitists, of a group of men who were the university professors, as it were, And they looked at Peter and John and said, these guys haven't been through the right kind of program. And they weren't impressed with them at all. But then, they weren't impressed with Jesus either, were they? These same men looked at Jesus and considered him unsuitable to be a rabbi, to be a teacher who taught with authority. So these men looked at the apostles, Peter and John in particular, in the fourth chapter of Acts, and said, well, these are just ordinary, ignorant men. And they were surprised at the way in which they conducted themselves because of that analysis. But let's consider these men, and I could have Dean probably give this lesson because I talked about the four fishermen when I was in San Jose a few weeks ago. But if Dean is like his son John, he doesn't want to come up here and do it for me, so I'll go ahead and say a few things myself. When we think of fishermen, sometimes I think we have the wrong idea. We think of them, again, in terms of being ignorant, unschooled individuals. Peter, though, was a very successful businessman. There's really no doubt of that. He is pictured in the Bible as being a very successful businessman. To be a fisherman was not a bad thing, because what was the number one protein source of the Mediterranean world in the first century, and indeed in a lot of the world in our time as well? It was fish. There was always a market for fish. When Jesus was going to feed the 5,000, what did somebody have on hand? Bread and fish. When Jesus was going to feed the 4,000, what did somebody have on hand? Bread and fish. When Jesus talks about giving your son food, your son asks you for bread, will you give him a stone? If he asks for a fish, will you give him a serpent? See, this was the ordinary, everyday food that people were eating. People ate a lot of fish. They ate very little lamb, very little beef, very little of those kinds of things. They ate a lot of fish, and much of the world today still does. America being rather exceptional in that regard. But fish was a staple in the diet of these folks. And Peter, being a Jewish fisherman, had a built-in market. Jesus illustrates this in the parable of the net. You throw a net into the sea and you gather in all kinds of fish. And then what do? You sort them out. And some of the fish are good fish and you keep them, and some of the fish are bad fish and you throw them away. Now, what makes a bad fish? Is that a fish that's been naughty? What's a bad fish?
Unclean.
A fish that doesn't have fins or scales, an unclean fish, a fish that the law of Moses proscribes. Now, if you were a Gentile, would you be throwing those fish away? The fishermen who fished the Mediterranean Sea, being largely Gentiles, they weren't throwing those fish away. And once you take your fish and you dry it or you pickle it, who can tell whether it's a clean fish or an unclean fish? So if you're a Jew, who do you want to buy your fish from? Another Jew. You want kosher food, right? You want to have food that is appropriate according to the law. And this is, it wasn't a commandment that you could not buy fish from a non-Jew, but it was a recommendation from the rabbis, even back then, that you should buy your fish from another Jew, because then you could trust that you were eating clean fish, that you were eating fish that would be approved under the law of Moses. So Peter had a ready market, right? When we meet Peter as a fisherman, we first meet Peter down by the Jordan River in the vicinity of the Dead Sea at Bethany across the Jordan. And at that place, Andrew has had Jesus pointed out to him by John the Baptizer as being the Messiah, as being the Lamb of God. Andrew has followed him and been very impressed after spending a day with Jesus. He goes, finds his brother Simon, and brings him saying, we have found the Messiah. Come and see him. And so Peter comes to Jesus. He's not yet named Peter. Jesus hasn't given him that nickname yet. But immediately Jesus indicates that he knows Peter. He knows who he is. He knows his character. He knows what he will be. He says, you will be called Peter. And I really think that that is meant to be a future tense there. You will be called Peter. It would be later that Jesus would officially give him that nickname at Caesarea Philippi when Peter says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus says, you are Peter, and on this rock I'll build my church, and so forth, all of that incident that took place there. The next time we encounter Peter is when Jesus is by the Sea of Galilee up in the area of Capernaum, which is where Peter lives, and Peter is throwing a net. He and Andrew have taken care of their night's work, the fishing through the night, and they're throwing a net while their partners finish up their night's work, getting the nets ready for the next day. Well, among the things that we can derive from the accounts of Peter were that Peter had partners in his business, right? Who were his partners in the business? James and John, and their father Zebedee was also in this business. So it was a partnership that involved the Zebedee family. Now, what do you know about partnerships? Is that an easy thing to be partners with someone in business? I don't think it is. Everything that I've seen about partnership in business tells me that there's a lot of problems with that. And I'm impressed when I read the gospel accounts and see that Peter, Andrew, James, and John got along real well all through the stories. And to me, that actually says something very good, because they not only were fellow disciples of Jesus, they were partners in the fishing business. But they got along real well, and that speaks highly of them. That lends to their credibility in some important ways. We know that Peter and his partners owned their own boats, plural, right? We know they had their own nets. We know that they were in the business of fishing to such an extent that they had employees, because when James and John walked away, they left the stuff with Zebedee and the servants, the hired hands that were there. So we know that they had a good business going. These were not men with nothing to do. These were not men who had no job and were just hoping for anything that might come along and give them an opportunity in life. They had stuff going on. They were busy men. They were men who were making a good living. We also can verify that from a glance at what I showed in the slideshow the other day, what is believed with a high degree of certainty to be the house of Peter there in Capernaum. It was a nice house. It wasn't a rich man's house, but it certainly wasn't a poor man's house either. It was an above average size house in Capernaum, where Jesus was a guest of Peter many, many times. And I add to that the fact that we know that after 3 years of ministry, when Peter goes home to Capernaum, when he is up there and uncertain about what's going to come next, when Peter says, "I'm going to go fishing," they still got boats. The business didn't go bankrupt while they were out running around with Jesus. They had a good enterprise going. And Peter was willing to put that on hold in his own life in order to follow Jesus. And it wasn't because he needed a job or needed something to do. He didn't become a preacher because he couldn't do anything else. He became a preacher because he was convinced that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. And he lived his life based on that choice. But he was a businessman capable of taking care of his responsibilities. And that's very clear in the things that we have about Peter. Now, we can look at personality issues and realize that Peter sometimes was a little spontaneous and sometimes a little abrupt in the things that he decided that he should do or wanted to do or the things that he would say. And we can identify with those kinds of characteristics, but the overall picture of Peter is that he was a solid, stable individual, that he was somebody that you would rely on, someone that you would consider to be a responsible man, and Jesus considered him to be a responsible man. In other words, someone who would be a credible eyewitness. He was a good choice to be an eyewitness and to leave an account of the things that Jesus had done. We also have a third eyewitness that I want to talk with you about here this afternoon, that being Luke. And by the way, of Peter, we know the same as with Paul, that his commitment to that eyewitness testimony was strong enough that he was willing to die for it, and did in fact die for it, which makes for a very credible eyewitness testimony, that it's a matter of life and death to stand for that truth. In Luke chapter 1, verses 1 through 3, Luke says, "Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus." And he goes on with a little bit more explanation of what he is doing in writing this first epistle. And then he also adds to it the book of Acts, which is a second volume of the same work, very clearly, very definitely. But did Luke claim to be an eyewitness?
No,
not of the things that are written down in the book of Luke. Now, we know that he was an eyewitness of some of the things written down in the book of Acts, because sometimes he uses the personal plural. We did thus and so. In Acts chapter 16 and in Acts chapter 20 and following, there are occasions where Luke talks about, "We did this, we went there, we did that." And we know that he is including himself as, in fact, an eyewitness in the circumstances that are taking place. But when it comes to the gospel account, Luke doesn't claim to be an eyewitness of the things recorded in the gospel. What does he claim? He studied it carefully. He investigated it. Who did he talk to? He did talk to eyewitnesses. So there is eyewitness evidence here that he has gotten by talking to original sources. And I am really persuaded that he talked to Mary in her old age, for one. When I read the account of Luke, I have a very high confidence that Mary was one of the people that he talked to. Everything in a proper way. And This part, I think, could have the potential of being a little bit tedious, and I hope that you won't feel that it's tedious. I elected not to do a word study with you, but I do want to kind of run through some of the things that verify to us the detail to which Luke can be counted on as a historian. Luke mentions in his writing numerous public people. This firmly roots his accounts in the real events of the times, and it also invites scrutiny and comparison with known facts. Should be an N on that word no there. That's just an evidence that, you see, I'm not as good at transmitting things even to the second generation as the copiers of the Bible are to the 40th or 50th generation, or however long some of those things have been copied and recopied. Luke mentions several Roman emperors by name. He mentions Augustus, he mentions Tiberius, he mentions Claudius. And he does not mention Nero by name, but he does refer to Nero when he says that Paul appealed to Nero being the Caesar at that time. Luke mentions several Roman governors. He mentions Quirinius and Pilate and Sergius Paulus and Gallio and Felix and Festus in various places around the Roman world. He mentions some of the Roman vassals in and around Judea, including Herod and Herod Antipas and Herod Agrippa I and Herod Agrippa II and Bernice and Drusilla. He mentions several Jewish leaders, including Annas and Caiaphas and Ananias and Gamaliel, and we've already mentioned Gamaliel today. And on another day, I just mentioned in passing that the ossuary, the bone box of Caiaphas, had been found recently in Israel, and very likely a high level of confidence that it is the Caiaphas that is mentioned to us in the gospel accounts. Well, in every case where Luke talks about these people, Luke is right on with the time, with the title, with the place. And I'm going to give you a series of references and go through them just pretty quickly where Luke mentions these people and these places, or that is, some of these people. In Acts chapter 13 and verse 7, Acts 13 and verse 7, this is when Paul, along with Barnabas, visits Cyprus. And when Paul is there in Cyprus, he refers to the proconsul, Sergius Paulus. Now, what we need to realize in going down through this list is that the Roman Empire was a pretty complex government system, and that the government officials were different from place to place, depending on what kind of a Roman territory you were in. When we are in Cyprus, Luke refers to the proconsul Sergius Paulus, and we know that Sergius Paulus was, in fact, the governor, the proconsul on that island, because inscriptions engraved in rock, inscriptional evidence has been found identifying him. There's also secondary historical evidence from a somewhat later period indicating that there were Christians in the family of Sergius Paulus. And you know, in that story in Acts chapter 13, Sergius Paulus was very interested in Paul's presentation of the gospel, so much so that his personal sorcerer was very much up in arms and upset about the whole thing. We have, in Luke's account, this individual, Sergius Paulus, identified as a proconsul, and that is the right term for this man. That's the right office, the right official term for the position this man held. When we go to Acts chapter 18 and verse 12, we are talking about some of the a different type of Roman region. Let me turn and read that passage. Acts chapter 18 and verse 12. While Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews made a united attack on Paul and brought him into court. Achaia and Asia were governed by proconsuls after 44 AD. Before that, they were governed by a different type of Roman official, different title. Gallio, the man Luke mentions here, is known to be the brother of a famous philosopher and poet, Seneca, and became proconsul in July of 51 AD. Elsewhere, when Luke talks about this region, he refers to it as Greece, using a generalizing term. But when he talks about this man, Gallio, he specifically identifies him with his proper Roman title, which is Gallio, the proconsul of Achaia. When we go to Acts chapter 19 and verse 38, and all of these that I chose to use, I had several others, but I chose to use a list of these that come from F.F. Bruce's book, The New Testament Documents, Are They Reliable? Acts chapter 19, verse 38, Luke refers to proconsuls here. If then Demetrius, this is the riot in Ephesus, if Demetrius and his fellow craftsmen have a grievance against anybody, the courts are open, And there are proconsuls. They can press charges. Well, that's kind of a strange thing for Luke to say there are proconsuls, plural, because usually a region would be governed by a proconsul, singular. But Luke says proconsuls here, and giving the quotation of what is said at the time of the riot. And it so happens that there was a period of a few months in 54 AD, when Paul was there in Ephesus, that the proconsul of Asia had been murdered. And there were two men who were vying for power, and both of them claiming the authority of a proconsul. And that was the case up until the time when the emperor intervened and appointed a new proconsul. There was an interval of time there, when Paul was in Ephesus in Asia, that there were, in fact, two proconsuls, two self-proclaimed proconsuls that were acting with authority in the province of Asia, as Luke records in this instance. And this, again, helps us to tie in the chronology, and the chronology works all the way through with Luke. He is very good at tying down when and where things are. Same chapter, Acts chapter 19, verse 31, Luke refers to some officials, and I think this is kind of intriguing. Some of the officials of the province, friends of Paul, sent him a message begging him not to venture into the theater. And I think it's kind of interesting that Luke does not refer to these people as believers. They probably were not believers, in fact. He says officials, friends of Paul. The actual word that Luke used there is the equivalent from the Greek would be asiarchs. And these asiarchs, these officials as we have it, were representatives of the cities of the province of Asia who presided over the provincial cult of Rome and the emperor, which means that they would be involved with idolatry, that they would be involved with the emperor cult. But Luke says that there were some of these men who were in this official capacity that involved the emperor cult, these asiarchs, who were friends of Paul and didn't want him to venture into the theater there in Ephesus, where he would very likely lose his life to the violence of the mob. We come down to Acts chapter 19 and verse 35, again in the city of Ephesus. And Luke makes reference to the city of Ephesus being the warden of the temple of Artemis. And there's a Greek inscription in ancient Ephesus in the ruins that describes Ephesus in exactly that same way. We go to Acts chapter 16, verse 12, Acts chapter 16, verse 20, Acts chapter 16, verses 35 through 39. And we read about those who were the governing officials in Philippi. And again, Luke uses exactly the right words for these people. This was a colony of Rome. And Luke uses the word praetors to describe the governing officials of Philippi. And that, in fact, is not their official Roman title. That is their adopted title. It was sort of a pretentious thing. And it is also attested to in the writings of Cicero that these colonial leaders liked to be called praetors. And Luke got that again exactly on target. And of course, he was in Philippi. This is one of the we passages in the 16th chapter of Acts. Luke was there and was quite familiar with the situation in Philippi. We go to Acts chapter 17, verses 6 and 9, and we have a different kind of leader in the city of Thessalonica. And Luke uses the word, the Greek word is politarchs. Luke refers to the politarchs, the city rulers at Thessalonica. And if you go to Thessalonica, there's an inscription there from ancient Thessalonica that refers to the city rulers as being politarchs, just exactly the terminology that Luke uses. And then going to the 28th chapter of Acts, which is where I'm going to stop with this particular kind of approach because I don't want us to get all burned out on throwing out Greek words, but the 28th chapter of Acts, in verse 7, we're on the island of Malta. Now, how did Luke come to be on the island of Malta? Because he's here. This is a we passage.
Shipwreck.
Okay? He and Paul and a number of other people were shipwrecked on the island of Malta. And he makes reference in verse 7. He says there was an estate nearby that belonged to Publius, the chief official of the island. Now, literally, that is the first man of the island. He welcomed us to his home and for 3 days entertained us hospitably. And the first man of the island, again, is exactly the right description. It is confirmed in inscriptions from Malta that that is what the governing official on Malta at this time was called, was the first man of the island. And when we back up from chapter 28 to chapter 27, we have Luke's account of the ship voyage, the voyage that brought them eventually from Caesarea to Rome, first of all with an unplanned stop in Malta after a lengthy, protracted period in a storm at sea. This passage, the 27th chapter of the book of Acts, is regarded as a classic of ancient literature, not only by people who believe the Bible, but by pretty much anyone who has ever read it. It's regarded as a classic of ancient literature. It's regarded as the premium account of what it was like to travel by ship in that time, and particularly what it was like to be in a shipwreck at that time. But all the details that Luke supplies of that shipboard experience are, again, right on target. Luke gives us exactly the way it was to be on a ship in that day and time. And some of the things he talks about are things that had really been kind of lost to history, again, until deep sea archaeology in the Mediterranean had been able to examine some Roman remains of Roman ships and to see a little more clearly some of what he was describing in this. But everything Luke says here is right on target for a man who was there, who experienced these things. And this is what I want us to think about in that connection when we are looking at Luke in chapter 28. And everything he says about the shipboard experience is well respected by historians, by those who are enthusiasts of literature, and certainly by those who are students of the Bible. Everything Luke says there about that shipboard experience is well respected as being very accurately portrayed, being true, right down to the last detail. And then we come into the 28th chapter, and we have Luke getting it right in terms of his discussion of the way things were on the island of Malta, including getting the right description of the head man of the island. There's no question that Luke was there. There is no doubt that Luke was there. So the question is, if we can trust what Luke says about the ship in chapter 27, if we can trust what he says about the island of Malta and the situation there and the way the people behave there, if we can trust those things, then can we count what Luke says in verses 1 through 6 of chapter 28 as being equally reliable? Once safely on shore, we found out that the island was called Malta. The islanders showed us unusual kindness. They built a fire and welcomed us all because it was raining and cold. Paul gathered a pile of brushwood, and as he put it on the fire, a viper, driven out by the heat, fastened itself on his hand. When the islanders saw the snake hanging from his hand, they said to each other, "This man must be a murderer, for though he escaped from the sea, justice has not allowed him to live." But Paul shook the snake off into the fire and suffered no ill effects. The people expected him to swell up or suddenly fall dead, but after waiting a long time and seeing nothing unusual happen to him, they changed their minds and said he was a god. Can we believe Luke's account of that? Well, if we can believe that Luke was right on target with all of the other historical data that we can check, then how can we have any doubt about his ability to accurately report what he saw there by the campfire that night when the snake bit Paul? See, how could we have any problem with Luke reporting this extraordinary event when we see that he is right on target with all the ordinary things that he reports? His accurate reporting of the ordinary should convince us of his ability to accurately report the extraordinary. There's no way to separate the two. There's no way to pick out bits and pieces of the story and say, well, you know, Luke was right on all this, but I reject the possibility of the supernatural, therefore he could not be right on this other piece. That simply does not work. It is a logical fallacy. It is not a reasonable frame of mind. We've had this quote up before, but I wanted to remind you of it. A man whose accuracy can be demonstrated in matters where we are able to test it is likely to be accurate even where the means for testing him are not available. Now, I like that quote. You may know that because I brought it up at least 6 times in the past week or so. I like that quote because it appeals to the way I think, which goes back to my early educational experience in mathematics. We did proofs exactly like this in mathematics, where you say, is this true for 1? Yes, it's true for 1. Is it true for 2? Yes. Well, suppose it's true for some number n. Is it true for n plus 1? If the answer to that is yes, then you come to the conclusion that it's true for all of those real numbers. That's the kind of approach that I'm talking about in thinking about Luke as a historian. Everywhere that we are able to test him, he comes out 100% accurate, right on target. There's no question that Luke was a good and careful historian. And so in all those places where we are not able to test him, we have a good basis for believing that he is still that same careful historian and right on target, unless we have a pre-existing prejudice against the supernatural. I want to move to a different area, a different kind of testimony, and talk with you about this for just a couple of minutes. Josephus is not a Bible writer, obviously, and I'm not going to have too much to say about him, but there are a few things from Josephus that I wanted to share with you. Josephus was a late first century Jewish historian. When I was a college student, I remember having a fairly low opinion of Josephus' credibility. I no longer hold that low opinion of his credibility. I'm persuaded that Josephus was a very competent historian. Not that he got everything right. He didn't get everything right. But that he worked with legitimate resources and that he made a very fair effort to bring the truth out in the things that he wrote. Now, he had his own agenda, of course. Every historian does. He had his own bias, of course. Every historian does. He was not an inspired man. But he still gave us a very credible record of most of the things that he wrote about. The testimony of Josephus. This is from an apologetic that he wrote. Some of his writings had been derided. He himself had been mocked and made fun of. His people had been made fun of by a fellow that he identifies as Appian. And this is from his response to that against Appian, a man who was an anti-Semite in that early day in the late first century. And I'm just going to share a couple of statements from Josephus from that volume of his writings. He says in the quote that's on screen, "How firmly we," that being the Jews, "how firmly we have given credit to these books of our own nation," and he's talking about what you and I call the Old Testament, "how firmly we have given credit to these books of our own nation is evident by what we do. For during so many ages as have already passed, no one has been so bold as either to add anything to them, to take anything from them, or to make any change in them. But it has become natural to all Jews immediately and from their very birth to esteem these books to contain divine doctrines and to persist in them and, if occasion be, willingly to die for them." Now, this is what Josephus said about the Bible, and he had a good basis for saying that. He had every confidence in the written scriptures of the Hebrew Bible. He said, "My people have this confidence to the degree that, when challenged, they would rather die than subvert or contradict or give up these scriptures. For it is no new thing for our captives, many of them in number and frequently in time, to be seen to endure racks and deaths of all kinds upon the theaters, that they may not be obliged to say one word against our laws and the records that contain them, whereas there are none at all among the Greeks who would undergo the least harm on that account, no, nor in case all the writings that are among them were to be destroyed." Josephus says it would be absurd to suppose that a Greek would stake his life on Homer. It just wouldn't happen. It never would have happened. And yet Jews would stake their lives on the sacred scriptures, and so would Christians. And so would Christians, including Peter and who was the other one I used? Paul. Boy, that's a bad mental block. Including Peter and Paul that we were citing as eyewitnesses here, and Luke. These men were willing to put their lives on the line for the very things that they themselves were writing down. And again, the historical testimony to that fact that they were willing to die for it is not subject to doubt or argumentation. We have, additionally, in the testimony of Josephus, something that I found very interesting. Josephus had a request that he made of Titus, the Roman general who was responsible for the destruction of Jerusalem and became the emperor shortly thereafter. Josephus asked for one thing. He was asked what he would like from Jerusalem, as I understand it, as I take the account there. He was asked what he would like from Jerusalem. And he said the one thing he wanted from Jerusalem were the books. He wanted the sacred scrolls and the books that were there. And how many he got or what he was able to carry away, we don't know. But Josephus does, from time to time, not only in his Wars of the Jews and his Antiquities of the Jews, Josephus does, from time to time, make reference to other historical materials that he had on hand. And in his treatise against Appian, he makes reference to several such historical documents that he had available. He talks about Manetho, who was an Egyptian historian, and whom scholars today would love to have a copy of the writings of Manetho, but they don't, who had king lists and historical records. And he cites Manetho as evidence for the Exodus and evidence for the longevity of the Jewish people in the land of Israel, Canaan, and occupation of the city of Jerusalem. Josephus also quotes from public records from Tyre, from Tyrian public records, which If you take his account there, it was reasonable for someone to go and look up these records, that he himself had done so, and those records were available. Now, they're not available in 1999. We don't have these public records from Tyre anymore. But he says you go and look at these public records, and he cites documentary sources, and he says that you find there these accounts of the interchanges between Hiram and Solomon. And I find that a very interesting line of evidence. We don't have the original documents anymore. We just have Josephus' references to them. But he claims that there are these Phoenician records that deal with the temple building period and the kingship of Hiram and his interaction with Solomon and the hired men that were involved and so on and so forth that still existed in his day and time. He cites another source for the same thing, that being Dia's History of the Phoenicians. For Solomon in the temple and the wisdom and the great reputation that Solomon had during that period of time. He cites Menander the Ephesian on the same kind of material about the old kingdom of Solomon and the temple and so forth. He cites a Chaldean or Babylonian named Berosus as a historian who deals with the flood and the ark and the Babylonian captivity. And my curiosity on that would be whether this is something a lot like the Gilgamesh epic or something else entirely that he's referring to. And I don't really know because we don't have enough details of what that was about. He cites a historian named Hermippus who quotes Pythagoras about Jewish law and custom from several centuries earlier. He cites Herodotus, a Greek historian, on the strange custom of Jewish circumcision. And he cites various other Hellenistic authors that talk about the dispersion of the Jews among the nations from the days of the Persians and so forth. So Josephus cites several ancient authors in support of the biblical record, and having those authors would be even better. But the fact that Josephus could say, you know, here's some sources that you can go look up 1900 years ago, lends credibility to the fact that a lot of the things that we see written in the Bible that today have no other support except the Bible, had written support of other types in ancient times that are no longer available, that have passed by the wayside since then. Another of the quotes that I have shared with you several times, in assessing the trustworthiness of ancient historical writings, one of the most important questions is how soon after the events took place were they recorded? And Josephus, like several other lines of evidence that we've looked at, lends credibility to the idea that the Bible is as ancient a source as it purports to be, that it was as close to the original events as it presents itself as being. We can rely on the antiquity and accuracy of the biblical text. Josephus was, in my conclusion, a competent historian. He had access to many ancient sources no longer extant, and his accounts support the authority and text of the Old Testament. His accounts also support the New Testament accounts, and I'm specifically thinking of things like the death of Herod Agrippa I and accounts relating to Pontius Pilate and his behavior and some of the other governors and procurators of Judea. These are things that dovetail with biblical accounts, with the accounts in the New Testament. There are also references that he makes that I think are legitimate references to James, the brother of Jesus, to John the Baptist, and to Jesus himself, that I think were legitimately a part of his original writing. But I'm really thinking in terms of his accounts of the setting in Jerusalem and Judea in those days, which dovetail very well with the New Testament accounts and sometimes record the same incidents as we have in Luke and in other sources. But he is demonstrably not as accurate as Luke or the other New Testament writers. For example, Luke refers to Pilate as the governor of Judea. He never calls him a procurator, although later, by the middle of the first century, that was what the governor of Judea was called, was a procurator. Pilate wasn't. He was before that change took place, that administrative change. Josephus, in writing about Pilate, does call him a procurator. So he makes an error in a historical detail in what he says about Pilate based on the way the situation was in later years. Luke never makes that mistake. Luke never makes that kind of mistake at all. But while Josephus was a competent historian, Luke was more than a competent historian. So Josephus is not as accurate as Luke, nor is he as close to or well informed about the events recorded about John, about Jesus, and about the church, although he doesn't completely ignore them. Other writers from the late first century onward affirm the existence and authority of New Testament scriptures by quotation and by reference, including Clement of Rome in the mid-90s of the first century. He was writing letters to the Corinthian church from Rome, and he was quoting the writings of Paul. So he was attesting to the antiquity and the acceptance of the scriptures in terms of the New Testament, even at this early date. We have writings from Ignatius in the second century, Polycarp, who was acknowledged as a disciple of John. He'd been trained under the Apostle John. Marcion, who was regarded as a heretic, but nevertheless left useful information about New Testament scriptures, quoting from them and handling them. Justin Martyr and others in the second century. We have a lot of testimony from non-biblical sources that tell us that the biblical text was written in the time frame in which it's presented and reliably and accurately brought down to our own day. We can have confidence in the text of the Bible. It has been accurately preserved. We can have confidence in the history recorded in the Bible. The witnesses are reliable. So what about the supernatural? Those things that cannot readily be tested. Well, I already asked that connection in regard to Luke. If we can trust Luke on all of the ordinary details, then can we not trust him equally on those matters that deal with the supernatural, with the power of God? If Luke, Moses, and Jeremiah, and I choose those three on purpose, if Luke, Moses, and Jeremiah, if you got those three, you've just pretty nearly got the whole Bible because of the places where they were in the sequence of events and the bringing together of the scriptures. If Luke, Moses, and Jeremiah can be trusted on the small details we are able to test, what about the accounts of miracles and prophecies? And we're going to particularly talk about prophecies on our last day, but right now let's think just for a few minutes about the miraculous. Now, that's really a very nice picture, and I'm sorry that you can't see it any better than that. It's a picture of a spiral galaxy taken from the Hubble telescope. It has more color in it than that too, but we're weak on color today and we're not going to bother to change it right now. We've had several references to the idea of creation, the magnitude of the universe that we live in previous lessons here. And I want us to think a little bit about that here this afternoon as well. Thus says the Lord, heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. Where then is a house you could build for me? And where is a place that I may rest? Now before I read on there, what's that saying to us about God? It says he's great. It certainly does. What else? You can't put him in a building. Not only can you not put him in a building, what else can't you put him into? You can't even put him into a universe. All right? The universe cannot contain God. Heaven is my throne, earth is my footstool. Where then is a house you could build for me? And where is a place that I may rest? For my hand made all these things, thus all these things came into being, declares the Lord. But to this one I will look, to him who is humble and contrite of spirit and who trembles at my word. So we have the claim here that God is outside the universe, operating within the universe but not a part of it, that God is greater than the universe, that the universe exists at his command, for his pleasure, for his purpose. Now, this is the kind of God that the Bible presents to us, a God who is not tied in any significant way to his universe except by his own interest and desire, not by any sort of need on his part. Now, that's really been Rick's topic in talking about the awesome God, but it pertains to the idea that we can accept the supernatural. What sort of God is it that we have, and what sort of God is it that we need if we look at science? Well, I want to make an assertion, and I won't have time to really justify this assertion in this class, but I do want to make an assertion that Bible fact and science fact do not conflict. Now, the Bible claims that certainly. It says the heavens declare the glory of God. Interpretations of the Bible and of science may conflict, though, right? We have to recognize that interpretations, my interpretation of the Bible may not be what the Bible actually meant in some cases and may conflict with science fact. Or my interpretation of science may not be what the facts of science actually indicate and may conflict with the Bible. So we do have a little bit of a struggle in that area. And facts and interpretation are often confused for one another. We're not always able to really sort out what is fact and what is interpretation. One example that I'll share with you, and it's not a tremendously significant or important example, but we have the notion that we know how the sun works. Tell me how the sun works. Fission. Okay. Atomic fission supplies the energy which we see radiating from the sun, giving light to this planet. You know that that is totally unproven? And it's absolutely, not only is it totally unproven, but the best evidence that we have is that it isn't true. They have set up the best experiments they could imagine to demonstrate that the sun is a nuclear furnace, and those experiments, every single time, have failed. The best evidence we have is that the sun is not a nuclear furnace, but we don't have a better explanation for what's going on in there. We have alternative explanations, but not a better explanation. Science fact and interpretation are not necessarily the same thing, and a lot of times what we take, what we presume to be science fact, really is interpretation rather than fact. And of course that is obviously true when we get to areas which Rick has touched on more so than anyone else, but also some other references have been made to dating things and to ideas about origins and so on and so on and so on. When we look honestly at the facts that are presented in the Bible and the facts that science is able to demonstrate, we will not, I have every confidence, we will not find contradiction between Scripture and science. I do want to make a point, and again this is a little bit redundant, but I do want to make a point of how the doctrine of creation threads all through the Bible. And this really is one of the things that makes me believe the Bible, is the way that there are themes that thread through it from beginning to end with utter consistency. Vesper was commenting to me earlier about looking at types from the Old Testament that are fulfilled in the New Testament. And if that was the only kind of information I had that would testify to me about the credibility of the Bible, I would be persuaded on that basis. Because I have dealt with other literature. I've been a reader all my life. I have dealt with literature, for example, just in the fiction realm, the writings of a fellow named Rex Stout. The hero of the Rex Stout stories is a guy named Nero Wolfe. And you know, from one book to the other, he's pretty good at keeping consistency in his characters, but he's not that good. There are changes that take place. He forgets things about his character from one book to the next. And especially when you then have the original author die and a secondary author begins to write about the same subject using the same characters, the characters are not the same. There is a noticeable difference in the character when a new author begins trying to pick up the threads. And a lot of classic characters have been treated this way, including James Bond and Tarzan and lots of others. Who's that detective guy? Sherlock Holmes and a number of others. And the secondary authors never managed to quite hit the character right. When I read the Bible, I am seeing the same characterization of God, the primary character, and of Jesus Christ, and of the work of the heavenly beings and of the nature of man and many other themes that thread themselves all the way through the Scripture. And that consistency is very, very impressive to me. The doctrine of creation is one area of that consistency. It would be fun, I think, to stand up here this afternoon and talk with you about some of the typology in the Bible. We could talk about David and Goliath, for example. That's a fun story to do this with. Or we could talk about the law of the kinsman redeemer and see how that's fulfilled in Jesus Christ. Or we could talk about any number. Joseph. We could pick up the Joseph story and see how that plays out in the story of Jesus Christ. And there are any number of these kinds of things that we could do that to me are a tremendously powerful testimony to God's book being the Bible, to the Bible being God's book, and it being utterly reliable and trustworthy for all those decisions that we seriously need to make in our lives. We have in the Bible this consistent thread of the doctrine of creation. In Hebrews chapter 11, which is referred to as the faith chapter because of all the things it has to say about faith, we're told that we need to believe that God is in order to please Him, don't we? And we're told in that passage that by faith we believe that God created the universe from an unseen origin, from unseen things. Out of nothing was the expression that was used the other day, ex nihilo. God brought the universe into being out of nothing. This is a basic of faith, to believe in God as the creator. In Revelation chapter 4:11, we're told that that's the basis for worshiping God, is that He is the creator. Unto Him belong glory, honor, and power, because He is the creator of all things. In Romans 1:20, we're told that this is the basis of moral responsibility. Now, there's an evolutionist named Simpson who wrote a book called The Meaning of Evolution several years ago. And his intention in that book, The Meaning of Evolution, was to lay out a groundwork for morality and a basis for culture from evolution. Guess what? It doesn't work. It does not work, and we see all kinds of demonstrations of the fact that it doesn't work in our world today. You cannot keep telling people that they are the product of random chance and have as much value as spit on the ground and expect them to behave with moral responsibility. You have to have a doctrine of creation. You have to have this notion of the divine origin of man to build a meaningful morality. And Paul makes that point in Romans 1:20. In John chapter 1, verses 1 through 5, we're told that the creation, the fact that there is a creator, that reveals to us who Jesus is. We cannot know Jesus in truth unless we realize his involvement in the creation of all things. In Romans chapter 5, verses 12 through 17, we're talking about sin and death there. This whole theme of creation is central to the theme of redemption. The work of Jesus is dependent on the story of Adam in the garden. If Adam didn't do that, then Jesus didn't need to do what he did. It doesn't make any sense. These ideas are all tied up together. We could also talk about the doctrine of judgment in 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 4 and 5. Peter talks about how all things, according to the mind of man, continue as they have been since the beginning, but people willingly forget that God has intervened in this world in the past and has brought the flood waters, and he will intervene again. The doctrine of judgment depends upon the doctrine of creation. The idea of the grace of God in Ephesians chapter 1 and verse 4 is tied to the fact that God is the creator. He can only give us this gift because he has this power, he being the creator of all things. The idea of God's omniscience, that God knows all things in all history, in Hebrews chapter 4, verse 13, is tied to the fact that God is the creator. He cannot know our destiny unless he is our creator. Revelation 17, 8 brings out that same idea. The goodness of God is demonstrated in the fact that he is the creator in 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 19, and in Revelation chapter 10 and verse 6. And God's plan of salvation, which is brought to us through Jesus Christ, is an eternal plan that God has known from the beginning what he would do in bringing this about, is also a basic element in Mark 16, 15, Ephesians 3, 9, Hebrews 9, 26. And there are several others, but I want to share the last couple of slides with you. And I told John I was going to quit at 20 till. This is the passage from Peter, and since you are aware of this passage, I won't spend time on it. Peter says this idea of uniformitarianism would be a real problem in the later days. In our day, it's a real problem. The idea that everything continues just as it has since the beginning, and everything can be explained on the basis of a long, vast period of time. And Peter says that simply is not true. I want to share with you from the writings of an astronomer named Robert Jastrow, a very nice little book that he wrote called God and the Astronomers, a book that I recommend. It's an excellent book. This is one of his statements after he talks about the progress of astronomy in the 20th century, and he is one of the leading astronomers of the 20th century. He says, now three lines of evidence, the motions of the galaxies, the laws of thermodynamics, and the life story of the stars, pointed to one conclusion. Astronomy led to this one conclusion from three different lines of evidence. All indicated that the universe had a beginning. Now, from the scientific point of view, that was not good news. At this moment, it seems as though science will never be able to raise the curtain on the mystery of creation. For the scientist who has lived by his faith and the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. We're not going to be able to get all the answers by science. The universe had a beginning. The astronomers, the physicists, they did not want the universe to have had a beginning. That was not good news for scientific inquiry because it means there is a barrier beyond which we cannot go, and it means that the universe is not infinite, neither in terms of its duration nor in terms of its extent. And Robert Jastrow says that the scientist now, the astronomer, the scientist, has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He's about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. And he doesn't like it, but he's stuck with it. The universe had a beginning. If it had a beginning, what was the cause? Well, the Bible tells us what the cause was and tells us in a very effective way the nature of that cause. Not a being within the universe, but a being who brought it into existence and has dominion over it. and is able to touch it at any point in space and in time. I have one announcement that David gave to me to make, and then someone has, Lee Wright has the closing and a song for us. The announcement is that Sandra has 3 copies left of the address list for those who will be leaving right away. If you're leaving right away, want a copy of the address list, you can get it from Sandra. And more will be ready later and will be on the front table.